For AZPM, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. All In for Autism Day will be here soon, and we'll meet a mother and daughter who are both on the spectrum of neurodivergency. The Maroney Theater at the U of A is holding a grand reopening. Go backstage to find out what the theater can now offer to both stage and screen audiences. Film essayist Christy Scheel reviews the first documentary film that will be screened at the Maroney Theater. It's called Body Parts. Plus, Stories That Soar brings us a very emotional song, showing how a fifth grader is using her writing to work through grief. Those stories are all next on Arizona Spotlight. Every spring, the Autism Society of Southern Arizona hosts a community event called All In for Autism Day. It's a resource and activity fair specifically designed to be enjoyed by people of all ages who are on the autism spectrum. Here are some guests who can tell us about what that means.
I am Kate Elliott. I'm the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Southern Arizona.
Tell us how your association with the Autism Society, how it began and how it's flourished.
I first found out about the Autism Society after my daughter, people started saying autism, after she was kicked out of three preschools pretty quickly, and I was lost about where to go. And so I called the Autism Society, and they helped me find a preschool that would accept her and help me get a diagnosis. And then when my son was diagnosed, I joined parent group and I started volunteering, and rest is history. Now I'm the executive director, but the Autism Society was there for me when I needed them, and I want to be there for other families who are in that same situation, because you get so lost and confused and overwhelmed, and we just really want to be able to be there to help people find the resources and connection, and to find the community. Spaces aren't traditionally made for autistic people, so we really try and create spaces and events where autistic people can come and thrive and meet their people and just have a good time and find their community.
When a parent finds themselves in the situation of their child has been diagnosed, what do you think parents really need the most?
Remember that your child is the same exact amazing child the day they were before that diagnosis. They are the day after. They didn't change. They're still them. All they can do is what they can do, and who they are and that kid you love is still that exact same kid. You're just gaining the knowledge that you need to be able to support them better so that they can thrive. But they're still your same amazing child. You didn't lose anything. You just gained some knowledge to support them better.
What kind of an opportunity is All In for Autism Day?
All In for Autism Day is our biggest fundraiser of the year, and it is just a big, fun day to come connect with resources. I think we have over 80 resources from over Southern Arizona to people can connect with any services they need while having a lot of fun. We tried to intermix it together so parents have a chance to actually talk to the resource providers while their kids are visiting Adventure Art or anything, and it's a good time to come together, meet resources, have fun in a place that everybody will understand your child. If we have meltdowns, we're prepared for it. We understand. We have a sensory space to come calm down. We try and make it as sensory friendly as possible and just find your people and help us raise money so we can keep doing our programming, which we offer free throughout the entire year.
I wonder about how you get together such a large group of people and have so many activities going on, but still make it a welcoming space for those who are neurodivergent.
A lot of it's about space, like making sure that we have enough space. We're not really tiny aisles. We have enough space to move around and freely. Also, it being in the carpeted room versus the non-carpeted room makes that pinging loud noise. And any noise that we generate is kept down at a minimum throughout the thing. We don't have big speakers going. It's more generated wherever the sound is needed. And so all that kind of stuff. And then we have the main room is a little more active, and then there's a side room that has a lot more places to rest and break, have a snack, and it's a little more quiet. And then we also have a sensory zone. If anybody needs to just completely escape everything, they can come in and play with sensory toys, lounge out, freak out, out whatever they want to do, dance around and have fun. And then just accepting everybody, because if you stim, however you stim and move around, we are here to accept it and love it. Vocal stims, physical stims, everything.
And can you explain stim for us?
Yeah. So stimming is a self-stimulatory behavior. It's something that all humans do, like tapping your feet on the, bouncing your knee or biting your nails. It's something that just releases that energy and helps a body regulate. Autistic individuals, since they have a higher rate of input and they have a higher rate of dysregulation in general, they stim a lot more. And so people may see them pace around, but it could be for good things, for bad things. My daughter cannot eat a bowl of ice cream without running across the room between each bite. It's just because she's so excited about how good it tastes, she has to run across the room and come back for another bite.
Yeah.
And so that's what stim is.
Do you think that there is evolution in the Tucson community regarding the neurodivergent?
Yes, I think that there's been such growth of the support systems and the people and even just the community in general. We have an autism-friendly communities training program where we go out and we train organizations, schools, we trained all of TPD, anybody, how to be more inclusive of the autistic community and what work that they do. And everybody, we don't have to advertise. There's constantly people wanting trainings all the time, whether we can keep up with. We have a lot of work to do, but it's grown a lot for sure.
Joining Kate Elliott for this interview were mother and daughter Nancy and Eliana, who is now 13. She received her autism diagnosis about 2 years ago, and mom Nancy then realized that neurodivergency is actually something that runs in the family. I wanted them to share some opinions on the subject, and I gave them questions written on cards for them to ask each other.
When you meet a new person, how long is it before being neurodivergent comes up?
I don't know, but I think when it's around that part is when I'm like saying I'm steaming or I'm very fidgety today and then I bring it up for no reason, but it depends on how close I am to that person, honestly, so just depends.
Yeah, and for me, I'm actually quite open about it. I'm also neurodivergent. I have ADHD. And I was diagnosed a few years ago after Eliana, and I am very open. I'm like, I am neurodivergent. Here I am.
What is something that you wish more people understood about autism?
I wish that people were more compassionate, especially when steaming. I think that's one of the things that get a negative sometimes. I like to bounce around a lot, and sometimes other people mimic me because I'm moving back and forth because I can't stay still. Sometimes people look at me funny, or they're like, why is that adult being so weird? And also, autism is not just one thing. It represents different in everyone, and there's no look for anybody being autistic. There's not one specific thing that fits everyone. And every autistic person has his own qualities, his own personalities, and they're individual.
We're different, and it's okay to be different. So it's kind of what I wish people understood.
What is a trope or stereotype about autism that you would like to see go away?
That it's usually just men or boys more than girls, because in a lot of shows and movies, I see they're usually men a lot of the time, which is kind of annoying because it's not just men that has it. So I feel like they need to add more characters that you can relate to. You can relate to the men, but it's different when it's a woman or a girl, because I feel like if there was more of that, it'd be better.
And then for me, one of the stereotypes again, one of the stereotypes that I find with women and girls, that they are too cold. They have no emotions. And that is definitely not true. As I said earlier, it's so different for everyone. And Eliana is such a sweet girl, and she has all those emotions, and she's not fitting into the stereotype that girls don't have any emotions. If they're autistic, they're not able to express themselves in that way. I was relieved and happy, and most importantly, proud of my daughter, who I love so much.
Thanks to Nancy and Eliana and Autism Society of Southern Arizona Executive Director Kate Elliott. All In for Autism Day is Saturday, April 13th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Tucson Convention Center Grand Ballroom on South Church. After being dark for almost a year, the Moroney Theater on the U of A campus has reopened following an extensive remodeling project, and its potential as both an entertainment venue and an educational resource has been expanded. I went over to the Moroney Theater to find out how.
I'm Matt Marcus. I'm the theater sound design professor here at the University of Arizona School of Theater, Film, and Television. I've been associated with the Moroney Theater since 2005.
I'm Jacob Bricka. I am the head of the production area in film and television at the University of Arizona and an associate professor. I teach classes on editing and post-production and documentary as well as narrative filmmaking. My connection to the Moroney is kind of recent, actually, in that it is now going to be possible for us to have screenings here. That's the big thing we're celebrating here, and so I'm looking forward to the future to bring my students here to watch films for classroom purposes, to having events where we can show things and in films and watch and hear them in a really beautiful, professional way.
So we're currently loading in the set and lighting and audio for our next production, which is Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. And this is the second day of load-in, so things are moving along.
Were there any changes that you want to tell us about that were made to make the backstage area more accessible or larger to increase your ability to do theater?
What has changed a lot is the technical infrastructure has been modernized. This theater was built in the early 50s, and since then there have been all kinds of changes that have gone on that maybe weren't done in the most professional fashion. You know, they're just done by the personnel that were here as best as they could. The infrastructure now is completely professionally installed, especially electrical and audiovisual transport throughout the building. And so it makes our lives in terms of loading in the technical aspects of a live production much simpler. Some of the other major things that we're changing here is we couldn't renovate a theater without changing out all the seating. So this is all brand new seating. It's been configured to match modern ADA codes, which it hadn't been before. As Jacob mentioned, there's a professional screening capacity in here now. The screen is actually, we call it flown out, but it is raised above everything we can see right now. And it lowers in and it covers almost the entire proscenium opening of the stage, so it's quite large. The projector is housed in the center technical booths, and it's permanently there. It's 20,000 lumens. It's probably the brightest projector on campus. It rivals probably anything that's in a commercial theater.
We're probably not going to even be able to put it at 100%. We'll be burning people's eyes out.
Right.
This is going to a theater and watching a movie. The sound, which Matt was intimately involved in making sure that this got designed in the best way possible, is something where you can sit down and really lose yourself in a film. And so that is just incredibly exciting. We, of course, are going to be trading time. We can't be in here at certain times when the middle of a set build is happening. But the way that the screen is flown in actually does allow us in a lot of circumstances to go ahead and bring it in front of whatever the stage is, whatever stuff is going on the stage behind it, and use it as we can, again, for classroom settings, for having guests, for having screenings where we invite the public, as in this event. So we're really just getting started.
Matt, can you tell me what the seating capacity at the theater is?
Depending on the production needs, it's anywhere from 275 to 320.
Jacob, do you have a screening coming up that you're excited about?
Yes, we are opening the inaugural screening of the reopening of the Moroney Theater as a screening space. It's happening on April 13th at 7 p.m. It's a public event. It's free. It's a screening of a recent film called Body Parts, which premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. We are bringing the producer and director from Los Angeles to show the film. We chose this film because it's about actors and acting. This opening of as a screening space is really bringing together the theater and the film and television sides of the School of Theater, Film, and Television. And it's about the history and current politics of intimacy on screen. So there's a fascinating section about nudity riders, which are the contracts that actors sign as they're agreeing to basically appear nude in some form or another on screen before a camera. And the incredible negotiations that occur contractually over this kind of thing, and then how that plays out actually on a set when, you know, a director may want to do something different, and the very tricky politics of that. There's a whole section on the quite new field of intimacy coordination, which is now becoming quite standard in our school as well as in the industry at large. It's a fascinating look at this.
Thanks to Professors Matt Marcus and Jacob Britta for the backstage tour. The documentary Body Parts has a lot to say. Here is film essayist Chris DeShiel with a closer look. DeShiel is an outside contributor to this show, and his opinions do not reflect those of AZPM.
We are used to thinking of movies and television as peripheral in a way, as entertainment and diversion from ordinary life. But because cinema became such a popular art form, most of us have grown up learning how to behave from TV and movies, learning how to act, how to be in relationships. And especially because sex wasn't talked about and is still often considered taboo, how to be romantic and sexual, how to kiss, how to make love. Body Parts, a film by Christy Guevara Flanagan, begins with this insight into the importance of motion pictures in our society and details the negative consequences for women and girls. Since the 1960s, when the Hollywood Production Code ended its control of movie content, nudity and sex scenes have become a common element in cinema. The pendulum swung the other way, and the movies got to a point where a nude or sex scene became practically mandatory. The excuse was that you needed an R rating to attract audiences, but this documentary shows that men were the boss in production, direction, and writers' rooms, while women were practically absent. Sex in the movies had the flavor of male adolescent fantasy, in which men are in control and women are just objects. Thus the film's title, Body Parts, the hypersexualized female body in film, has reduced women characters to an assortment of desirable body parts, not people.
When I first started my TV writing career, they were always looking for a female writer to hire. It's terrible to say, but at the time I felt really fortunate. I was like, oh, they're looking for a female writer. I could be that female writer. But of course I wasn't putting it together, like, because they already have a writer's room of 11 guys. And there wasn't a lot of interest in authentic female stories, I'll put it that way.
In some ways, I think there's a lot of 20 and 30-something male writers who they'd admit, I'm not really sure I want to know what's in a woman's head, you know? I'd rather stand out here and put a gun in a guy's hand and I'll write that story. In some respects, we may have been shirking it.
The lack of films by women telling stories from a woman's point of view has serious implications. It is both a symptom and then a cause of misogynist ideas. Women and girls don't see themselves portrayed as autonomous subjects with meaning and purpose, but mostly as romantic love interests or sex symbols. Guevara Flanagan includes interviews with people in the industry. Some of them, such as Jane Fonda and Rosanna Arquette, are well known, but most not. We learn that female actors were put under pressure to do nudity, or else lose their chance at a job. Actresses would say yes to a film involving nudity, but then experience sudden additions to the script or on-the-spot changes by a director that required more than they were comfortable with.
I went on set and I discovered that I had two nude scenes, not one. I was told that it was going to be empowering. In this industry, things happen so fast. They don't really, you know, sit down with you like, oh, we're thinking about doing it this way or this other way. When I saw the final product, I didn't think it was tasteful at all.
Then also, there was persistent abusive behavior on the set, with male actors transgressing boundaries because they felt entitled. The so-called casting couch, which nowadays means meeting a producer in his hotel room, was an exchange of being given a film role for sexual favors. When Harvey Weinstein and other male media figures were outed for sexual harassment and abuse, it wasn't as if this behavior was new, only that more women were standing up against it. The threat of being blacklisted has always hung over the heads of women in film who consider reporting abuse. We meet body doubles, women whose nude bodies stand in for those of other actresses. We meet a professional whose job is to airbrush and change images of women to conform to an unrealistic standard of beauty. Guevara Flanagan touches on many interesting aspects, but the most striking element in Body Parts are the many clips from film and TV. Her team must have put in a tremendous amount of work amassing what looks to me like at least 200 clips from many different periods and genres, illustrating the depiction of women and sex on screen. The editing in these sequences makes a compelling argument on its own.
Think about all the movies where men would be having an important conversation.
Here's to old friends.
And hot women would just be sitting at the table while it's happening, just like kind of just there as decoration.
This round's on me.
The way in which women can just be kind of present but unnecessary.
In recent years, there has been an emergence of more women filmmakers presenting stories from women's points of view, including films that depict female desire and the experience of sex as an active subject rather than as an object. Body Parts also pays tribute to this hopeful development. Creative freedom and equality results in good new movies. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Chris DeShiel.
The Moroni Theater's debut screening features their newly installed projection and sound system on Saturday, April 13th at 7 p.m., and it's free. The filmmakers of Body Parts will be on hand for a Q&A following the movie, and ticket information is at theater.arizona.edu. The Tucson nonprofit Literacy Connects sponsors a professional group of performers and musicians called Stories That Soar. Their mission is to help young writers realize the potential of bringing their stories to life across all mediums, including radio. Daisy, a fifth grader at Holloway Elementary, wrote this touching song. It's a love letter to share what her life has been like since kindergarten, when her mother passed away.
I miss you, Mom. but it hurts after all this time still. Wish I could hug you again, and I know you're in heaven now, but I want you to know that you're still my hero, and I love you so. Can you hear? I miss you more.
That song was written by Daisy, a fifth grade student at Holloway Elementary. Go Coyotes. It was performed by Jordan Fouts, a member of the Stories That Soar ensemble. Aspiring student-age writers can submit their stories, poems, and songs to the Magic Box Story Portal now at literacyconnects.org. And listen for more Stories That Soar every month on Arizona Spotlight. Thank you for listening. This show is a production of AZPM. The music is by Calexico. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. Production assistance by Alicia Vasquez. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.